Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Shades of Entrepreneurship. This is your host, Mr. Gabriel Flores. Today's guest is an entrepreneur who started a community growth platform called Orbit, which is an online community growth engine that drives growth. With Orbit's single shared view of membership and activities, communities can create cohesive messaging. It also has a reporting system to gauge the impact and improve return on investment. One area I saw this platform performing well is employee resource groups, also known as ERGs. What is an ERG? Why is it important? And why should an entrepreneur care? Employee resource groups are groups of employees who join their workplace based on shared characteristics or life experiences. ERGs are generally based on providing support, enhancing career development, and contributing to personal development in work environments. In my experience, an ERG provides resources for learning and development support through formal and informal opportunities by creating employee networking activities. These networking activities do not have to simply come from one employer. In fact, I am one of the co-founding members of the Oregon Health and Science University Latino Employee Resource Group. The group was officially formed 10 years ago, almost to the day in 2012. Since then, our OHSU ERG has grown over 200 members and has just as many subscribers to our newsletter. Furthermore, I've recently established the Pacific Northwest Latino ERG Consortium, which is the collection of ERGs for other organizations throughout the state of Oregon. Those organizations include, but not limited to, Airbnb, Nike, Adidas, Moda, Cambia Health Solution, and many more. The intent behind the creation of the Pacific Northwest ERG Consortium is to share best practices between our groups. You see, ERGs are not only about networking and leadership development. It is also about being a resource for decision makers and leadership concerning the structure of organizational policies, staffing, community needs and concerns, brand awareness, and that is why ERGs are important. However, one of the biggest pieces that is needed in order to have successful ERG is securing executive support. One way I gained executive support was making bullet points with supporting data highlighting the benefits of an ERG. According to Sequela Consulting Group's 2021 Employee Experience Benchmarking Report, 40% of the companies have employee resource groups, a 9% increase in 2020. This is in line with the uptick in diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI, initiatives as the pandemic and racial injustice awareness created new challenges and opportunities for employers to evolve their employee existence, according to Sequela officials. DEI has been researched time and time again, and the data always supports diversity. In 2020, McKinsey & Company, a global management consulting company, did a study called Diversity Wins: How Inclusion Matters. In that study, McKinsey & Company found that diverse companies are more likely to financially outperform their peers. In that same study, McKinsey & Company found one-third of its firms they tracked since 2014 had achieved real gains in executive team diversity. However, about 50% have made little or no progress, and with that, many have seen gender and ethnic minority representations even go backwards. Another point this study made: promoting diversity does not ensure a culture of inclusion, and that is why the entrepreneur should care. As I've stated time and time again, I work in healthcare. If you look across the healthcare industry, you will see many hospitals failing financially right now. Although there are many factors, one issue hospitals are facing right now is staffing. There are not enough American-born workers taking up healthcare as a profession, creating a huge staffing hole for our aging population. In turn, healthcare systems are turning to nurses beyond our country's borders to bring in healthcare staffing to support our community needs. In Oregon, 20% of licensed healthcare workers speak another language, according to the Oregon Health Needs Assessment. ERGs are not simply about diversity in cultures. They are about the diversity in our communities. At OHSU, we have over 10 different ERGs, from OHSU Pride to Veterans to International to the Older Employee Resource Group. Any staff member can join an ERG to understand what issues other communities are facing. It is about creating awareness and opportunity through fairness and transparency. It is about fostering a multicultural, diverse organization as diverse as our communities of entrepreneurs. Thank you, and I hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to the Shades of Entrepreneurship, where we interview entrepreneurs to inspire the future. host, Mr. Gabriel Flores. So grab a drink, sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. Has over 10 years of marketing and customer success experience from leading successful teams at Keen, IO, and Figure Eight. He is the host of Developer Love Podcast and co-creator of Orbit One. Please welcome Patrick Wood.
This episode is sponsored in part by Burnside Knives, essential tools for outdoor enthusiasts and working professionals like yourself. Visit burnsideknives.com. Your knife says a lot about you.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Shades of Entrepreneurship. This is your host, Mr. Gabriel Flores. Today, I have the founder of Orbit, Patrick Wood. Patrick, how are we doing?
Hey, Gabriel. Thanks so much for having me on the show. Very excited to be here. I'm doing pretty great and excited to have this conversation.
Yes, but now before we hear about Orbit, let's hear about Patrick. Who is Patrick Woods? Give the audience a little bit of background.
You know, as a founder, it's hard to separate myself from the company. So it's hard to describe one without the other, I would say. But I'm Patrick. I'm the co-founder and CEO of Orbit. You know, my career blends a few different chapters, sort of grew up in digital marketing, worked in an ad agency for a while, transitioned from kind of the digital analytics side of the agency to doing brand strategy. At that agency, I created a business unit to focus on startups. So essentially providing services for equity, like naming services, brand design, things like that for early stage companies. But instead of getting paid cash, we got paid in terms of equity. That introduced me to the whole wonderful world of startups. One of my clients was a company called Keen.io. Keen was an analytics API, kind of an early stage company, Sequoia backed, just classic, developer driven, bottom up, community led kind of a company. And Keen was a client, and they recruited me to be their director of customer success because they had lots of users, lots of customers, and no one looking after them. And that was a big part of my job at the agency. So I moved from Memphis, Tennessee, where I grew up, moved to San Francisco to join Keen, and really joined the startup joyride, if you will. So it was at Keen for a while, learned a lot about community as a driver of value for both the business and the community members. Keen had probably around 50,000 developers on the platform. So tons of people building cool stuff and talking to each other about what they were building. After Keen, I went to a company called Figure Eight in the machine learning space. And then around 2018, I got the band back together with my now co-founder, Josh. Josh was the VP of engineering at Keen.io. And we started doing some consulting in kind of the developer relations, developer community space, just really helping companies accelerate their programming there and be more thoughtful and strategic. And really, that sort of led to the modern era of Orbit because a couple of things happened during that time. One was that we spent time with, dozens of companies, hundreds of leaders in the space, and we realized everyone was, all of these companies were investing in community programs and didn't know how to measure the sort of efficacy of those programs because it seems very nebulous. And this will sound a bit philosophical, but the sort of sole commercial metaphor for measuring things in business since 1888 essentially has been the sales and marketing funnel, or maybe 1898. But suffice it to say that the funnel as a metaphor is great for optimizing a linear process like a product onboarding or enterprise sale. But community growth, community is not linear, it's not binary. And so we realized that it's really hard to measure community with the funnel. So we took a step back and we created a framework called the Orbit model, which said this is the way you can measure organically the way communities expand and grow and fade over time. And we sort of launched that as a blog post, kind of as quote unquote thought leadership for the consulting practice, but it really hit a nerve with our audience. And so people started to say, cool blog post, how do we do it? How do we take this theory and turn it into practice? Mm-hmm. And so what we did was we fleshed out the concepts. We put some of the underlying math into some Airtable templates. We had a small Slack community of our own. And then with that, we sort of raised our first pre-seed capital in late 2019 before we had a product. So we were pre-product. We basically just said that, look, the way people buy software and buy most things has shifted from a top-down sales motion to a bottom-up adoption-centric motion. And the tooling for managing that process hasn't really hasn't really been born yet. Like all the existing tools in the enterprise are very premised on a buyer, a seller, and sort of a transaction. And so, you know, our premise was that we need to reimagine the go-to-market from the bottoms up, from the ground up in the context of an adoption-centric go-to-market. But we've got to build it on top of better data models and better mental models. And so that's sort of the story of how we went from kind of like early ideas into building, you know, launching Orbit. So yeah, we launched in 2019, we started in 2019. We launched publicly about a year ago, May of last year. Today we have many thousands of customers, some pretty great ones like Stripe, Okta, Patreon, Miro, Vercel, and a number of others that are sort of very community-led, community-driven companies, primarily in the software space, as well as a lot of growth in Web3, gaming, and e-commerce as well. So yeah, basically at the end of the day, we help our companies, our customers really understand who's in their community and what to do about it. So yeah, so I've been thinking about this stuff for a while, as you can tell. In addition to the stuff we did at Keen, I've produced events in the past, you know, hosted, you know, monthly meetups and dinners and things like that. So been thinking for a long time about how communities impact the people in them, but also the sort of like bigger business they might be associated with.
So just to kind of clarify, Orbit in itself is kind of a digital platform to create communities, kind of correct? Is that summarize it, or please, maybe, is that accurate?
Yeah, sure. So basically all of our customers share a couple of things in common. One is that their community is important. It happens online and it happens across a bunch of different channels. Right. So a typical Orbit customer they'll have activity happening on GitHub plus a Discord server plus Twitter plus Meetup plus Product Hunt plus Reddit. And you just sort of like the list goes on about where these conversations, where these interactions are happening. And so on one hand, the community is super important. On the other hand, it's distributed across dozens of unending number of places. And so sort of at the bottom of the hierarchy of needs, if you will, what we do is we make it really easy for our customers to connect all those data sources and get a single view of what's going on across those channels. So at the individual level, you can see, okay, a month ago, this person followed us on Twitter. And then the next day, they subscribed to our newsletter. And then 2 days later, they came to our Discord forum, asked a bunch of questions about the product. And then the next day, downloaded a free trial and started using the product. And then a month later, you know, referred a friend. And so really, it's this idea of taking all these disparate data points that are spread across these different channels and across the product and unifying it into a single view. And so at the individual level, you see the full journey. What it means is that as a second order effect, you have that individual data that then rolls up into company-wide data. So Orbit can say, hey, did you know that last week there were 8 people from Acme active in your Orbit? You know, 2 followed you on Twitter, another came to the meetup, another one requested a copy of the PDF. And without a tool like Orbit, you probably wouldn't know because it happens across a bunch of platforms. So it makes it really helpful to understand which organizations are engaging in. And there's a bunch of reporting that comes out of that, and then some workflow automations, the messaging, some things like that.
Now, you mentioned one of my favorite things. You mentioned data. I love getting into data. I love kind of scrubbing data. Where do you mentioned getting your data sets. Where do you get these data sets with this information, and what kind of information does it kind of have, just to give the listeners a general idea of what you're kind of looking at and analyzing?
Yeah. So the two main concepts in an Orbit workspace. So if you were going to use Orbit today, you would go to orbit.love, you would create an account, create a workspace. And inside a workspace, we keep up with the community members themselves. So this is an individual. So this is Patrick Woods. A member has various identities. So I'm Patrick J. Woods on Twitter. I'm Patrick J. Woods on GitHub. And then members do activities. And this is kind of like one of the fundamental differences between Orbit and a traditional sales CRM, because we found that modern businesses want to know what people are doing across channels. And so an activity is any verb that someone does. So it could be followed on Twitter. It could be joined the forum. And you could basically imagine anything. And so how do we get the data? So there's a couple of ways. The most common way is using one of our 20 or so integrations that we built. So the Twitter integration, for example, is under the hood. It's a Twitter app. So you click connect in the Orbit workspace. It goes to Twitter. You authorize the app into your Twitter account. And then we go and pull in recent mentions, recent follows, things like that. And going forward, anytime someone follows you, anytime someone retweets you, mentions a specific keyword that you want to keep track of, that creates an activity in your workspace. And so the member is, you know, Patrick J. Wood, the activity is follow Gabriel on Twitter. And so every integration does something similar. So for the Discord integration, the Discord bot that sits in your server, when people join, when people ask questions in specific channels, when they reply to threads, those are all activities. On GitHub, there's a number. And so basically, you think about any platform, like on Meetup, it would be RSVP'd for an event. And so the initial phase of an Orbit, you know, experience is connecting these data sources using our integration. So typical implementation process takes 10 minutes, could be longer. Aside from the integrations, we also have a Zapier app and a Make app, if you're familiar with Make. So we, you know, really lean into the low code, no code sort of part of the world. And then underneath all that, we have an API and webhooks. So our bigger customers build some pretty complex workflows.
And the beauty of it is the customers see absolutely none of this because it's kind of all operating in the background, correct?
Yeah, it's similar to any other kind of like marketing sales tool. It's behind the scenes. So it doesn't require anything from the end user to have to sign up or anything like that. It just happens automatically based on the public interactions that are happening.
Now, you mentioned, you know, you recently kind of just started the business. Let's talk about, you know, how you started the business and the financing part. Is it a grassroots effort? Did you go venture capital? How did you start to finance this company?
Yeah, we're venture backed. So we raised a few different rounds. The first one, as mentioned, was a pre-seed. So it was, you know, shy of $1 million basically. And that phase was basically, you know, can we go and prove out the demand for a tool like this? Because the sort of vision for Orbit at the time, there was nothing really like it in the market. And so the first question is there a market here? What should the product look like? And then can Patrick and Josh go build it and convince people to use the early version? So we started in late 2019. Of course, 2020 was the sort of beginning of the pandemic. And so the first half of 2020 was, you know, very chaotic like it was for everyone. But one thing that we experienced was that because of COVID, because of the shutdowns, basically every company's event marketing budget and events programs sort of went away. And so there's no more conferences, there's no more meetups. And so every company moved everything online. And all of a sudden, the world is wondering, how do we track and measure this engagement across all these different channels? We all suddenly have to do community online and we don't know how to do it. And so that was very helpful for our business because it just drove a ton of demand. We've done very little, you know, paid advertising promotion. It's pretty much all been organic, community driven, based on sort of those tailwinds from the market. So I guess late 2020, we raised a seed round from Andreessen Horowitz, and then early 2021 did a Series A from Code2 that A16Z participated in. Yeah, and then went live middle of last year. So, but yeah, we've been venture backed the whole way.
Now, one of the things you mentioned was pre-seed. For the listeners at home, that may not be familiar with venture capital and going through that process, what does pre-seed mean?
Sure. So the historically, each sort of round of capital that a company would raise would have a couple of factors associated with it. Basically, how much the company is raising, the valuation of the company, and then sort of the maturity milestones for every phase, if you will. So, you know, today, these, as you can imagine, are sort of fluid over time. Every decade, sort of, there's a bit of a reset. A pre-seed has historically been, you know, let's raise somewhere between 250 and 750, you know, a million kind of on the high end, to fund a team to go do like the basic research around a problem set and basically de-risk a few things, de-risk the executions. So like, can the founders build it? Can they find something that looks like it's going to work? You know, of course, at the very early stages, no one's expecting ARR or, you know, recurring revenue at that point. But it's basically the investors and the founders basically saying, yeah, like, we think there's something here. We really need to go focus on it. We need some capital to go do that. Let's figure it out. So the next phase, you know, typically, if you've done a pre-seed, and some companies don't do a pre-seed, sometimes you just raise a seed round, but a seed round is typically, it's been very different, honestly, from 2021 to 2022 in terms of like the round sizes. So over the past couple of years, the seed round might be 2 to 6. We saw some big ones last year, like 8 to 10, which is pretty out of whack with historical ranges. But at the seed, it's like, okay, we need to start to build a team around this because there's some demand here. There's some pull in the market. We've got sort of, you probably have like a beta version of the software. You know, maybe you have some design partners you're working with. You've got a few dozen, maybe 100 people using it, getting value. And so you've sort of proven out the minimum viable product. You can build it. There's people that want it. Maybe you've got some revenue, often not. But really now that you've de-risked the early parts. And so now you need to de-risk the, you know, can you build a team? Can you start to drive revenue? Can you start to test some go-to-market? Can you build a community? And then by the time you get to the Series A, the Series A is kind of like the bigger round. It can be 10 to 15 to 20 or more. You know, by then it's like, okay, you need to be getting to revenue, approaching $1 million in ARR. And then, so basically every stage has kind of like investor expectations from it, kind of like what you need to do with the money, and kind of milestones that you are signing up for essentially for the next round of funding. So yeah, they just call it the series C to series A, B, C is kind of just the shorthand that the investor people use to demark what round we're at and what stage is the company at.
What would you say are some of the difficulties, kind of like maybe some aha moments going through the venture round that you're like, wow, I didn't expect that, or maybe some difficulties that your team ran into trying to raise funds?
Yeah, well, on one hand, we had a lot of, we were very lucky to be raising capital in the prior market. I mean, it was just, the economy was flush with cash. And so I would say some of the lessons we learned is that there's a degree of interpretation required around investor feedback. There's an interesting thing that I've observed where an investor is, they're the business of essentially gathering as much information as they can, you know, so they'll ask you a lot of questions about your market size, your customers, key problems, who else you're seeing in the market, and they're information gathering machines. And so that is useful. You know, there's almost always upside for an investor in a conversation because they're collecting data, they're putting that data in spreadsheets. The firm is crunching that data to figure out which companies to invest in, which markets to go into. So there's not always symmetric value in a conversation. So they're always asking questions, getting information. The other thing is that they're always trying to keep the option open to actually do the investment. And so it's sort of like dating in a weird way, where the first conversation's like, it feels really good, everything's going great. You know, they're saying this is awesome, we're really excited, and then they're very excited until they break up. Like all of a sudden, they send you an email that says, well, you know, the market's not big enough, you're not far enough along, whatever. There's all these reasons they give you that they never mentioned before. They until this point, until the breakup, it's just like flattery because they want to keep the option open as long as possible to do the deal or not.
Makes sense.
Until the last minute. And so I experienced early on a lot of whiplash from that because, you know, you build a relationship, you invest time, you're like, oh, this person really gets the business. This is going to be a great partner. And then all of a sudden they have all these objections they really hadn't mentioned until it's too late. And so I found that it's not usually a conversation that's very transparent on either side. You know, like if VCs have questions maybe about, you know, market sizing or burn rate or things like that, they often don't ask them because they don't want to like turn you off as a founder, because often, you know, you're talking as a founder to multiple investors. And so, you know, there's a fear from VCs that I've picked up on that if they're too direct, if you do a feedback, then maybe you know, they hurt your feelings and you take the money from someone else. And it's like this really strange dynamic. Hmm. But as a founder, you know, you really just want the information, you know, like, and in fact, you really come to value people that'll tell you the truth.
Yeah, good point.
It's all we have. Like, we have to make decisions based on the data we have. And, you know, so that's some of those challenges were pretty interesting. And trying to read the tea leaves of what people are really saying behind the things they're actually saying.
Yeah, you got to always read between the lines kind of thing. Now, what would you say was like possibly like the easier part about it? Or was there anything easy about going through those seed rounds?
You know, we've been very lucky, I would say, to have an interesting product at the right time. The market's been good. We live in San Francisco, or I live in San Francisco. My co-founder, Josh, he lives in Paris, but we've both been in startup world for a long time. So we've been fortunate enough to have just a really great network of people that, you know, both angel investors as well as institutional, you know, venture capitalists. So yeah, I mean, I think we're pretty privileged in that regard. So it's not been easy, but I think it's probably been a lot easier than it's been for a lot of people, simply because we're one degree of separation away from a lot of people. So, but that's just, there's not really any advice in that one, I guess, other than maybe geographical proximity to capital is still, I think, really important.
You know, actually, you brought up one point that I think that's kind of important, that, you know, indirectly, and that is networking, right? You're talking about your network, right, of your individuals that you know and your partner knows.
how important has your network been to building, you know, these companies? You mentioned Orbit's actually not your first one. How important has your network been to kind of grow yourself as an entrepreneur?
Oh yeah, it's been maybe not everything, but boy, it's been a lot. I mean, we can credit our network with early capital. So our first angel investor, the first person who committed any dollars to Orbit was a guy named James Tamplin. James was the founder of Firebase. Firebase had a pretty massive exit to Google. James is a friend of my co-founder. He's a friend of mine now, but he was a longtime friend of Josh, my co-founder. They have a Burning Man camp together for the past many, many years. And so, you know, it's like we're getting started. It's like a couple of calls and James is in for his check size. And so then we can go to other people and say, look, James is in, he's a big deal. Like you should be in. And it's sort of that first check just unlocks everything. And so it was complete from the network. And, you know, not only was it just in the case of James and a lot of our early investors, it's not just any money, it's money from people that also have networks.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So it's multiplicative. And so, yeah, we've benefited a lot from early investment in those relationships and trying to keep those warm and just meeting people. And, you know, it's kind of like the classic serendipity thing. You never know. Like you go to a meetup,
certainly.
You run into someone 5 years later, you know, they're your VC, you know, it's just, and so a place like San Francisco is still pretty good because there's so much density around that. Of course, online there's plenty of things that are happening online too. And increasingly capital is distributed, but regardless of whether it's in person or not, I mean, investing in the network, it's like there's no downside.
Yeah, certainly. I think that's one thing that's been, excuse me. I think that's one thing that was been common throughout this podcast is just highlighting networking and the importance of networking. And it's not like what you know, it's who you know a lot of the times, because those individuals, you know, I say this often when you're climbing up this, you know, so to speak, corporate ladder and you're reaching down and helping other people's up. Eventually we might slip and fall down that corporate ladder, but it's those individuals that have been, you know, we've been helping up along the way. They're going to kind of reach out to prevent you from falling even further kind of thing. And so it's interesting how the networking is such a kind of a big thing. In fact, if James ever needs somebody to join him at Burning Man, please do let me know. I'm always available. Now, Patrick, what motivates you? I mean, you're grinding. You're doing quite a bit. What motivates you to keep going?
I think it's a few things. It's the chance for impact, I think, is maybe the highest level bucket. And that I think there's probably a couple parts of that. I feel pretty fortunate to be able to do this, to have a startup, to have raised money from amazing investors, to have really incredible customers, you know. And so it's pretty motivating to have some of the most interesting companies using our tools and saying, yeah, this is helpful. I'm improving outcomes for the business. I'm helping the community grow. I've become a rock star. So I'm not sure what's like under that. Maybe it's probably some deeper Freudian motivation here, maybe. But I think just the chance to go do that. I don't know. Like building a startup has been a thing I've wanted to do for a long time, and so like I feel very motivated by the chance to build a thing that has big impact, both in terms of creating a category, building a business, employing a lot of really amazing people. I think the team aspect of it is pretty motivating for me. Our team is spread across the U.S. The UK, France, and a couple of West African countries, Benin, namely, and Cote d'Ivoire, Nigeria. And it's an incredible group of people that are all thoughtful, kind, super intelligent. And so, you know, to be able to have a team of people that I learn from, I'm inspired by, is pretty awesome. And of course, to have the chance to mold and shape that culture versus being like part of something else, you know, I mean, I don't know. It's nice to be be in charge, I guess, when it comes to that sort of stuff, and kind of create the kind of place that I want to work and Josh wants to work. So that's a pretty huge as well. And what we're seeing is that if a company has a thriving community, it basically makes every other part of the business easier. It makes sales easier. It makes marketing easier. And for the community members, it means they're getting answers faster and they're meeting people and they're probably getting jobs. And so there's many like second and third order benefits to the outcome of communities getting bigger and better and healthier. So there's like a long-term impact. I think it sounds kind of cheesy, but like on society, if we can help companies get better at this and scale this up, then I think it actually makes people's lives better because all the reasons I just described.
You know, and I think too, where I see Orbit possibly leveraging, you know, that opportunity to kind of build into the corporate world is really focusing on the employee resource groups. Because I think with larger institutions, there's a lot of employee resource groups. I know I'm part of one here at Oregon Health and Science University. I'm also kind of starting this kind of consolidation of employee resource group throughout the state of Oregon that we're trying to kind of create this cohesion between us all, kind of determine what are we doing. And this is exactly where I see Orbit kind of fitting in, right? Love to hear about what our ERG members, you know, Latino ERG members are doing 4 hours south, you know, and kind of still engaging in that community. Now, as a business owner, first, why startups? Why'd you get in the startup world?
I don't know. I have to really introspect on that. I would probably say the speed that things happen has always been attractive.
Okay.
Being able to take a big swing really quickly and know if something's going to work or not has been attractive. I think, you know, building something from scratch certainly isn't limited to the world of tech startup, but, you know, again, getting back to the impact thing, it seemed to me like the most efficient and effective way to build something quickly to have an impact, you know, versus maybe, I don't know, bootstrapping or doing something else. So yeah, I think the culture around the startup space has always been attractive in the sense that it's a very, you know, fast moving, people are smart. There's lots of open learning, you know, open source software is kind of like the sort of first version of this, but more and more people are publishing their learnings, like learning in the open, sharing what worked and what didn't, doing big retrospectives on this company didn't work out, here's why. And, you know, there's a big bias towards learning. And that's always been really attractive to me too. So I think those are some of the things. And I just being surrounded by really smart people is always fun. Like I've always blown away by the types of people I get to meet and work with and even employ. And so it's kind of like the best place for somebody who wants to learn and just be surrounded by really elite folks. It's kind of the best place to do that, at least in my experience.
Yeah. Now, what advice would you have for the listeners at home?
Oh, in general or with business or any?
Let's think from an entrepreneur's perspective, what advice would you have for an entrepreneur that maybe is thinking of getting into the startup world as well?
I think doing the work to get clarity on, you know, your individual motivation and like to your last question, I think that's been pretty key. So, and this is actually one of the questions going back to James Tamplin, who I mentioned earlier, one of his first questions to us was like, why do you want to do this?
Yeah.
he was a founder. He had been through the ringer. He's like, are you sure? You know, like what's, do you think it's going to be easy? Are you reading TechCrunch and think it's all just like raising big rounds of money and doing exits?
Right, totally.
Like,
yeah.
It's actually really hard. So, you know, really doing a gut check on like, what is it I want to do and why? And is that why going to keep you going through the hard times? Because, you know, it's, we've seen many ups and downs in Orbit. Orbit's about 3 years old, coming up on 3 years, I guess. And, you know, we've been through COVID, we've been through a war, a recession, you know, the market's gotten hot, you know, competition shows up, you know, like it's just like many ups and downs. People leave the company, you know, like for good reasons or bad reasons, whatever, you have to let people go.
Yeah.
And it's just a lot of stuff. And as a founder, it turns out that the thing you want to do, I guess I'm kind of like just rambling a bit here, but I would say that, you know, what I found is that the idea of starting a company and building a product that's really cool is a great starting point. But as a CEO, you do a lot of stuff that's not building a cool product. Like you work on that some, but you also do a lot of chores. It's funny, one thing Elon Musk said, and, you know, we can say a lot of things about him, I guess, but you know, basically one of the things he said is like, being a CEO is just, it's about doing your chores. And if you don't do them, it's going to be bad. So you just got to like taxes, accounting, HR stuff. You know, there's a lot of that. So I guess it comes back to like understanding why you want to do the thing and then gut checking the sort of reality of, hey, it's going to be a slog. And maybe talking to some people that have been there and done that. I mean, when I think about my own network, the having connectivity with other founders who are both at my stage, like kind of like Series A, but also people who are like further beyond. Really excellent to have those people share perspective, because you know, investors are great. They'll try to give you advice and stuff like that. But really only a founder who's kind of been there and done that or is currently in those same trenches as you are can bring that same perspective. And so, you know, it's useful to just have a conversation with a few people that have done it before. And, you know, if you've never talked to anybody that's done a startup, talk to some people who have done one and make sure it's for you because it's not easy.
Man, I keep telling you folks, network, get out there and talk to people, right? Get out there and listen to their stories. It's quite impressive how much you can learn from other people. I mean, you know, we're kind of at the best time in our life where we actually do have every possible knowledge, you know, at our fingertips. In fact, it's probably in our phone, in our pockets right now, right? But also people in books and just having that opportunity. Now, where can the listeners find Orbit? If they're interested in the product, they're interested in kind of finding out more, where can they find you guys online and on the social media?
Yeah, definitely. So our website is orbit.love. That's right, L-O-V-E. It's kind of a funny domain name, but it's there's a bigger brand story. So I mentioned the Orbit model we created earlier in the call. By the way, you can read about the Orbit model at orbitmodel.com. But there are several parts of the Orbit model. There's gravity, there's reach, and there's a metric we call love. And we say love is basically the recency, frequency, and quality of every person's interaction over time. And we actually measure that with the product, but it's part of the Orbit model sort of idea. So the website for the product is orbit.love. And it's always fun to tell people that because, you know, my email address is patrick@orbit.love. And then it's a conversation about like, what's the deal with that? And so we lean into that from a brand standpoint. So you can find us there. We have lots of resources on our blog about community building, about tactics and tools and programs and best practices. And we have a community of our own. It's predominantly community builders, founders, developer advocates, folks like that. You can find us at discord.orbit.love. Join in and sort of follow along. We do office hours, do fireside chats in the server. It's really fun.
Nice.
And then me personally, I'm just at Patrick J. Woods on Twitter. So always happy to help founders talk about these topics because it's a rewarding journey, but a tough one as well.
Man, yeah, no, you and I feel like you have a lot of experience to give a lot of individuals that are seeking it. Thank you, Patrick Woods. Man, thank you so much, the co-founder of Orbit. I'm again, folks, if you're interested, please get online, check out the orbit.love for more information. I've already been looking at the actual online because again, Patrick, in fact, we'll probably chat a little bit after this because I think there is an area for Orbit in the ERG world. For those folks listening at home, please subscribe to the newsletter at theshadesofe.com or follow me at theshadesofe on all of the social sites, including TikTok. Yes, we finally got there, folks. We are on the TikTok. Thank you and have a great night.
Thank you for tuning in to The Shades of Entrepreneurship. For more information, please follow The Shades of E on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or visit theshadesofe.com.